session number 16075, Reel 2.
Crew Captain Goodman, Reel 2. Any particular operations from your first tour that stick out in your mind apart from the ones that we've already talked about?
Yes. There was one on 37 Squadron at Feltwell when I was second pilot. I was second pilot for my first half dozen trips with Pilot Officer Clark. He had been a flight sergeant fitter before the war who became a pilot, and I learned more from him, I think, than from anybody in the Air Force. Not only was he a first-class fitter and a first-class pilot, he was also a first-class navigator, and he taught me navigation and also astro-navigation. He was an incredible man. Anyway, we went on a trip. It was during the bombing of the invasion barges. We went to Rotterdam, and we were flying at about 8,000 feet. We could see it quite clearly. Flares had been dropped all around the area by Wellingtons and Whitleys, and bombs were bursting in the dock basins. We could see all this going on. And we homed in on the place, and Nobby opened the bomb doors, and the navigator was down in the front directing him, saying left, left, or right, or steady. And we were coming along towards the target, steady, steady, steady. And Nobby was looking out through his window on the left-hand side, port side, and I noticed that the speed was dropping. He was looking down at the ground and easing the control column back, so the nose was coming up a bit and the speed was dropping back. And, of course, a second pilot was not allowed to start telling his skipper what he should be doing. Anyway, the bombs went. We could feel them all going. 250 pounders all going down, and Nobby leaned forward and closed the bomb doors, and at that point there was an almighty whoomp underneath as an anti-aircraft shell went off, and our speed was under 100 miles an hour. I could see this, and the Wellington then reared up and stalled and then fell over on its starboard wing and went into a right-hand spin. Now, I know that people don't believe that Wellingtons will recover from spins, and if you read the pilot's notes, you were forbidden to spin them anyway, and rightly so too. Anyway, the thing flailed down in this spin to the right, and we were then looking ahead of us, or downward ahead of us, and we could see all these lights going round and round and all the flashes of the bombs going off, and I thought, we've had it now. And Nobby Clark blasted the engines open and closed quickly to try and shake the Wellington out of its stable attitude, and it did nothing. And then he called jump, jump, which was the signal for everybody to bail out. And my job then was to pull myself forward and let the front gunner out of his turret. And I couldn't move. I was pinned in the corner, the frame at the back of the cockpit. And I looked across at him again, and he'd still got full left rudder applied, but he was quite a small man. And I thought what I ought to try and do was help him to apply left rudder. So I lurched across the cockpit and grabbed the right rudder pedal and pulled back with all my might and felt it move a bit. And then he blasted the engines open again, and there was a great shudder, and the Wellington came out of the spin. And we were then getting down to quite a low level. There were these dock lights ahead of us, below us, of course, but apparently ahead of us. And he eased out of the dive, and we were going then like blazes. And we got down pretty well nearly to ground level before he started to climb very gently back up again. And he tried the controls carefully, and he found that he couldn't move the elevators very well. He couldn't move the control column forward or back very well, so he realised there was trouble with the elevators. And we flew back to Feltwell and came in to land, and he didn't use the flaps, because as soon as you use the flaps, the nose of the aircraft would come up, and then you've got to push the control column forward, and he couldn't do that. So he came in and landed. And when the engines were switched off, we went round and looked at the back end of this thing, and found that the elevators had moved bodily on the rollers that they they were on, the rollers on the tailplane, and they were within a fraction of an inch of coming adrift completely. If they'd done so, of course, the elevators would just have disappeared. They would have torn off, and that would have been the end of us. And so we were within an ace of death. It was a very salutary lesson for me to watch the speed. I always did it very carefully after that. And Nobby, to his eternal credit, agreed that he'd let it get a bit slow. But people on the squadron were amazed. I think everybody was amazed about this because, really, we should not have been able to get the aeroplane out of the spin at all. It should have flailed on into the ground. And no one would then have known what had happened to us. So that's my line shoot about Wellingtons and spinning. When I was an instructor at 15 OTU Harwell, after I finished my tour, we had a flight commander who'd been in British Overseas Airways before the war, and he started one day saying, you know, it should be possible to get a Wellington out of a spin in 8,000 feet, and everybody said, oh, don't do that, for goodness sake. And I was one who led the cry, don't do that, sir. But sir went up, and he went up to 8,000 feet and closed the throttles and put it into a spin, and he didn't come out. He just flailed on down and made a great hole in the ground outside Harwell, which was quite amazing.
I think that when you were training, doing training work on Wellingtons, you took part in the 1,000 bomber raids
yes.
in 1942.
Yes, that's right. I was then a screened pilot, as it was called, or screened instructor, screened from operations. That's a laugh, isn't it? Because we all had to go on the 1,000 bomber raid on Cologne and Essen. From Harwell, we sent 32 Wellingtons, and we lost two, both from my flight, B flight, both friends of mine, Jack Hatton and Jack Paul, and they were all made prisoners of war, and they all came back at the end of the war, so that was good. And we sent 30 Wellingtons to Essen, and they all got back. And they were all training Wellingtons, and they had screened pilots and screened navigators and screened wireless operators, but the gunners were all student. And for luck, we carried a student pilot as well, who came along just to see what was going on. It was a bit hair-raising, really. The Wellington I had wouldn't go above, I think it was 8,000 or 9,000 feet. And the reason was that it had got aileron droop. The controls wires weren't as tight as they might have been, so both ailerons drooped down a little bit. It was like putting flaps down. So you couldn't get much speed, forward speed, nor would the wretched thing climb. But I think that may have saved us, because the heavies were up at 18,000 feet, and then the Wellingtons were at about 10,000 feet, and that's where all the fighting was going on, and we were down at 8,000 feet. And I think that we were really, in an odd way, protected. We didn't see anything, we just bombed. And when we bombed, by the way, at Cologne, the smoke was up to our level. We flew through smoke at 8,000 feet.
Did you feel when you took part in these 1,000 bomber raids that this was a turning point in the air offensive against Germany?
Yes, we did. It had all been very unsatisfactory till then, and now we could see the target. It had been marked. It had, in fact, been marked by what we might term early pathfinders. A row of red flares had been laid to the east of Cologne, and a row of green flares to the west, and you had to bomb between them. So that was the beginning of Pathfinder tactics. And it was very successful. An enormous area of Cologne was gutted, destroyed, and we had never managed to do anything like that before. And, of course, Butch Harris had then taken over bomb command, and from then on we were driven by this extraordinary man.
Did you meet him?
Not until after the war, I'm afraid. No, I was much too lowly ever to meet him, I'm afraid.
Now, whilst you were doing the training work at Harwell, what was your attitude towards going back into operations?
Oh, well, I knew we'd got to. You see, you had to do 30 trips for a first tour, and then you did a period of instructing, which might be a year or a couple of years. I did just under 2 years. And then you had to go back and do another tour. And if you went on heavies, Lancasters or Halifaxes, you did 20 trips, which means that your total would then be 50. Once you'd done that, according to all the rules, you couldn't be called upon to operate again. That was your lot. You'd done 50 trips, that was it. We had Hamish Mahaddy, Wing Commander Mahaddy, coming round to the training units, and he was the training officer for the Pathfinder Force 8 group, and he used to give talks on the Pathfinders and how important they were, and he was looking for people to join them. And of course, some of our pilots who'd been screened for some time, they responded to his blandishments, one of which was, if you're not a flight lieutenant, you very soon will be, so you'll soon be getting some more money. And if you do well, you'll find yourself made an acting squadron leader, which some of them were. And my bosom friend, Ambrose Smith, went back in July, I think it was 1943, to a Pathfinder outfit. And a few weeks later, he flew in to Harwell in his Lancaster, very proud of himself. He'd been made an acting flight lieutenant already, so he was getting more money than I was as a flying officer, and I felt very envious and was thinking about volunteering as well. He flew off back to his unit, and then he went on ops the next night and never came back. And his name is on the Runnymede Memorial of those for whom there is no known grave. So that was Ambrose Smith. But I was still thinking over what to do when suddenly a posting notice arrived for me, posting me to Marham in 8 Group, which was the Mosquito Station. So whether or I liked it or not, I was going to join the Pathfinder Force. This was mid-August 1943. There were 3 units at Marham, 2 squadrons, 105 and 109, and number 1655 Mosquito Training Unit, commanded by Wing Commander Roy Ralston, who had done a lot of hair-raising daylight raids on mosquitoes in 1942-43, a great hero of Bomber Command. Now, the two mosquito squadrons that were there were shrouded in secrecy. They had nothing to do with we people who were under training, and they walked around and people talked in hushed whispers in the mess, and there was an odd character going around. His name was Dr. Jones, I remember, and when we were in the mess, Dr. Jones would be called for all the time, and I wonder what sort of doctor he was. I thought for a start that he was a medical doctor, but it turned out that he wasn't a doctor of medicine at all. He was a boffin. In fact, he was responsible for the aids with which these mosquitoes were fitted, an aid called Oboe. And Oboe was a magnificent marking aid. It operated on the principle that there were two beams, one in the north of Norfolk and one down in Kent, one bisecting the other, and one beam was laid out across the Ruhr, and the other beam triggered it at intervals. The pilot had to fly his mosquito at 25,000 feet along the beam that led to the target, and he had a device, he listened to it, and if he was drifting off the beam, he heard dots in his earphones, and if he was drifting off to the right, he heard dashes. So he got to get a steady note, and he got to keep a steady note, so he got to fly absolutely accurately. And then 6 minutes before the target, he would receive a signal from the ground station that was triggering the beam, and he then had to concentrate very much. And when he was within a very short distance of the target, he got another signal, and then finally he got a signal to drop the bomb, and he pressed the button and dropped. Now, it all sounds rather odd, but a good oboe crew, or perhaps I should say a very good oboe crew, dropping a bomb from 25 or 28,000 feet at which they operated, could get that bomb within 10 yards of an aiming point, which is quite incredible. And of course a not so good crew could get it within 100 yards. But if you were laying a marker, for example, with 200 or 300 aeroplanes coming up behind, a 100-yard error from an aiming point really is neither here nor there. But what these oboe crews used to do, certainly in the winter of 1943, when there was fog over the airfields in northern France and Holland, they would fly over at 25,000 feet and try and hit the officers' mess of these places. And they scored some very good hits too. I think the Germans were really put in fear now and again as these bombs came crashing down on top of their living accommodation. But the marking done by Obo was absolutely fantastic. And they had led the Battle of the Ruhr, about which I spoke earlier on. They led the marking on the Battle of the Ruhr. And they did some splendid marking after that. Well, when we had finished our training on the training unit, we would either go into 105 or 109 squadron, or to 139 squadron, which was at Witten. And 139 squadron was the squadron that used to operate across Germany using this H2S that I've spoken about. And it could drop bombs quite accurately, not like Obo, but you remember that the H2S was a downward-looking radar, and you could go anywhere over Germany using it. And a good H2S crew could get good bombing results with H2S. But 139 was also the nucleus of what was to become the light night striking force of 11 Mosquito squadrons, which were in the end equipped with 4,000-pound bombs. And 139 would be the marker squadron for these squadrons, and they would go to the, particularly to Berlin. And night after night, there would be Mosquito raids on Berlin. What would it be? Should we say 10 squadrons with putting up 9 or 10 aeroplanes? Be 100 Mosquitoes, each carrying a cookie, a 4,000-pounder, led by 139, marking with H2S. A fantastic business. I was on 139 for a short time only, and we had 3 flights. I said we were the nucleus of the light night striking force. And in November 43, the first of these squadrons was formed at Oakington, number 627. We had 3 flights, A, B and C flight in 139. C flight was the flight which was to be the flight from which 627 was created. And in the middle of November 43, we flew across to Oakington in our Mosquitoes. And the proud boast of 8 Group, led by Air Vice Marshal Don Bennett, who was the AOC, was that as soon as a squadron arrived on a station, it had to be operational. And we arrived at Oakington, and the whole station was alive. There was to be a maximum effort, and the target that night was to be Berlin. And we were to take part in this. And 6 Mosquitoes were put on, including myself. And as the afternoon wore on, it became evident to the powers that be that there was going to be a lot of rain coming in early over our bases in Lincolnshire and East Anglia. And it was decided at Bomber Command headquarters by Harris that the Lancasters were not to go, the heavies were not to go. So it was to be an all-mosquito effort. And then, although we didn't know it on 627 Squadron, all the other Mosquitoes were stood down, and we were the only ones left. And we therefore had to go. So we scrambled in the early evening, and away we went. And what I didn't know was that we had come down to 3 aircraft, and the other 2 aborted with various troubles. And Bill Hickox and I set off for the big city on our own. And we didn't know that either. We thought we were part of an all-mosquito effort. And we flew to Berlin and dropped our bombs. We were not fired at. Nothing happened. We didn't see anything. We dropped our bombs on the estimated time of arrival over Berlin. And we may have hit it and we may not. And we flew back. And the worst part of the trip, in fact, was getting down at Oakington, where the cloud base was about 500 feet and it was pouring with rain. But we got down okay, and that was that. And that was the first operational sortie of 627 Squadron, and the only operational sortie by Bomber Command that night. Well, we carried on doing these kinds of operations, and we joined in with Bomber Command heavies. And during the winter of 1943, there were 16 major bomber attacks on Berlin. the idea being to bomb it flat and make the Germans surrender. In fact, we were never able to achieve the kind of accuracy that we needed to make the Germans surrender, and we lost a lot of aeroplanes. And we, Bill Hickox and I, did 7 of these trips. We were always with the heavies, and our job was to fly either ahead of the heavies and drop the confusion aid, the anti-radar aid window, thousands of metallized strips which you dropped, and they confused the enemy radars. And once you did that, of course, it threw all the fighters off as well and gave all sorts of false blips. We would have to go off at an angle to the main line of approach, say 45 degrees one side or the other, and window like hell for 50 miles, and that would draw off some of the German night fighters. But I think it's true to say that once the night fighters had found the bomber stream, they stuck to it. And they did a pathfinder technique on us then, because they used to fly over the top of the bomber stream, dropping flares over the heavies. And by the light of these flares, the night fighters would come in and worry away at the flanks of the bombers, the Lancs and the Halifaxes, or look out for somebody who was on his own, a lame duck, somebody on three engines having a heck of a job to get along, and they would pick them off like that. And we, up at 25,000 feet, would have a grandstand view of all this. Another job we had to do was to go in at 0 plus 1 hour, when all the bombing was over, and bomb the centre of any fires seen and take a photograph of what was happening on the ground. Usually these raids were quite a pushover. The Germans by then, the defences had usually been overwhelmed, and they took no notice of a lone mosquito coming over. Even if it dropped a few bombs, they weren't going to waste any shells on that, and we would get away with it without any bother. So that's the kind of thing we were doing in the winter of 43. But then early in 44, Wing Commander Geoffrey Leonard Cheshire took a hand. He was up in 5 group, we were in 8 group, and he'd started doing pinpoint marking of targets in France, and he was going for factories. It might be, say, an aero engine works, powder works, ammunition dumps, you name it. Anything that was a precision in character, he was going for. The dam busters, of which he was the commander. And first of all, he was doing the marking in a Lancaster, which was a very clumsy aeroplane at low level and very vulnerable, of course. A Lank picked up in a searchlight at low level could be blasted off the face of the earth quite quickly. So Cheshire thought that what he needed was something a bit more useful than that, a bit more nimble, and he thought the Mosquito was the thing. And so he sought an interview with the AOC of 5 Group, Air Vice Marshal Rafe Cochrane, and suggested that what they needed was a Mosquito to do this. And Cochrane agreed and interceded with Harris, who said all right, and before long, 2 Mosquitoes arrived at Woodhorse Bar, where Leonard Cheshire and the Dam Busters were located. And they tried this out, and they tried this low marking business, and found that it was just the job, using a Mosquito. The idea was that you had to get around the target area, get it illuminated by Lancasters, flares dropped over the top to make it as light as day, and then in the light of that, the Mosquito would look around for the target, the factory, shall we say, and then bomb doors open, and the pilot would dive on the target, a shallow dive, you know, about 40 degrees, not in a 90-degree dive or anything like that. That would be silly. You didn't need to. About a 40-degree dive, you filled your windscreen with the target area, and when you were at the right point at about, say, 500 feet, you pressed the button and released the markers, and they went down on top of the factory. And in a very short time, you could become very skilled at getting these markers right on an aiming point or right beside it. So Cheshire and the Dam Busters were knocking out these targets all over France. And Cochrane reasoned that if a one Mosquito squadron, a one Mosquito could mark for a squadron, then one squadron could mark for the whole group. And so he put it to Harris that this would be a very good idea, and Harris agreed and interceded with the chief of the air staff, and it was agreed that one of Bennett's precious Mosquito Pathfinder squadrons should be transferred to Woodhall Spa to mark for five group. You can imagine what a fuss this caused. And, of course, the squadron that was selected was 627, of which I was a member. We flew off up to Woodhall Spa. We didn't much like the idea of this marking at low level, as we'd been doing all our work at high level till then. But in a very short time, we were quite skilled at doing this marking job. And, of course, Operation Overlord was coming up. We knew that the invasion had got to happen soon. And what we didn't know was the strategy for it. The landings were to be in Normandy, and the strategy was to isolate Normandy so far as communications were concerned, in particular the rail system, to knock out the French rail system. And the idea was that by doing that, it would prevent the Germans from reinforcing their divisions in the beachhead area. It would mean, if we could knock out a big proportion of the French rail system, that the Germans might send, shall we say, a panzer division by rail, which they did. It would take quite a large number of trains, of course, to move a panzer division, but they could move it fairly quickly. But, for example, the panzer division located at Toulouse could have moved in its entirety up to Normandy in 5 days. In the event, because of what we were able to do before Overlord, it took 2 weeks to get there. This is an example of the slowing down that had to be achieved. The idea was that in the beachhead area there were 8 German divisions, and we could get ashore a maximum of 8 Allied divisions. So 8 would meet 8. And we could then build up quite quickly after that, but so could the Germans, unless we were able to slow them down. But it meant that at 0+2, I think it was, or D-Day plus 2, we would have 10 divisions in the beachhead, and the Germans would have 12. And then we would have 14, and the Germans would have 18. And we would have 16, and the Germans would have 21, which was not going to be an operational war at all. It would be a massacre in the end. We'd be pushed back into the sea. So this business of isolating the beachhead was absolutely vital. And Churchill, in his wisdom, said, all right, well, OK, we'll have a go at half a dozen of these marshalling yards and see what we can do. But it's got to be done very carefully, very accurately, because we're not going, I will not allow French civilians to be killed needlessly. The figure that was agreed, incidentally, was 10,000. We were going to accept 10,000 French deaths in isolating the beachhead. So forward we went to have a go at these marshalling yards, and the technique was really very simple. It was designed by Cheshire that mosquitoes would mark each end of a marshalling yard. They were usually shaped like a lozenge, so a blob of markers at each end, and even the most stupid Lancaster or Halifax pilot could then steer between the two blobs of red on the ground and drop his bombs. And one raid I remember in particular was on the marshalling yards at Juvisy, Paris, which was done early in April 1944. And there are two famous pictures, one showing the marshalling yards before the attack and one after.